You're listening to Midori House First, broadcast on the 28th of June 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme, as Russia wades in on the US's claim that Bashar al-Assad is planning another chemical weapons attack, we'll ask where the intelligence behind the claim came from and why the US chose to make it public. My guests Robert Fox and Shashank Joshi will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including trouble on the Indian and Chinese border. We'll learn why the two nations aren't seeing eye to eye. And we'll also look at the relationship between China and the UK and discussing why Hong Kongers are a vital component of it. All that plus the looming political comeback, can it be true, of Silvio Berlusconi? Can politicians ever bow out gracefully? That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Robert Fox, London Evening Standard Defence Editor, and Shashank Joshi, Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute for War and Conflict. Gentlemen, good to have you both with us. Here in the studio, we turn to war and conflict for our first topic this week. The White House has warned that a chemical weapons attack from Syria's Bashar al-Assad could be imminent. Russia, perhaps unsurprisingly, has called the assertion unacceptable. And the war of words has now pushed the US to attempt to go into some detail about where, other than Assad's own rather grisly track record, the claim has come from. Robert Fox, to start with you, why would the US make this knowledge public and make the pronouncements in the way they did at the time that they did?
Well, there's a lot of turbulence and it's very much interconnected. I was in Israel last week. They were having the Herzliya Security Conference and it is very much on this matter. The word du jour, it was supposed to be, by the way, Herzliya majoring on ISIS and Daesh. It wasn't at all. It was about the sheer arc, sponsored primarily by Iran, and this is related to it, which goes through from the Mediterranean to the Gulf to the Red Sea, from Latakia all the way down. And they were saying Hezbollah, on behalf of the Syrian and the Iranian regime, have completed the link because there is now a corridor. I think Trump, and I mean Trump himself, seems to have swallowed this. And the whole thing, the nuancing about Qatar was not... It were, well, they were behind Hamas, perhaps, through the Muslim Brotherhood, but far too pally with the Iranians across the Gulf. And they lender us Carthago, sorry, Carthage must be destroyed. It was a drumbeat. There was a continuous theme, you know, the chief of staff of the Israeli Defense Forces, the head of the Air Force, it's a real threat. And they would come up with actually staggering figures. The figures that staggered even more than when I was there in March. You know, 240 Hezbollah villages along the Lebanese border, one in four houses. They've now got, in March, it was just over 100,000 rockets. Now they've got 150,000 rockets, according to Israeli. There's a lot of war talk going on. Mm. And it seemed to me that parts of the White House, not just the White House, there are elements in the US armed forces that seem to be obsessed by a potential threat from Iran, particularly the US Air Force. And I do think that it's part of the piece, because as we've drilled into it, and I'll just finish with this, they say they've seen suspicious movements by surveillance on the same site that they trashed with the Tomahawks back in March, was it? Yeah.
And Shashank, that's an interesting point. And often we've seen, whether we were talking about Qatar over the last few days or this latest warning over Syria or any other issues around instability or potential flashpoints in the region, that we often seem to come back to this point about the great sort of proxy conflict, whether, you know, you're looking to Iran and Saudi. Is one of your concerns here maybe that Trump and those around him in the White House simply don't have any, well, I was going to say a nuanced understanding of that, but any understanding of it?
Well, I think Robert's right. They perhaps have too much understanding of it. They've perhaps absorbed one narrative too much, which is of Iranian dominance of the region, of course, egged on by Israel and more by Saudi Arabia. And we've seen in previous weeks how they have been shot an Iranian drone out of the sky. They have attacked Syrian aircraft, which was threatening US-backed rebels. They have repeatedly, I think, struck Iranian-backed militias on the ground, threatening Syrian Democratic Force troops. So, of course, this must be looked at in part of a broader Trump Trump effort to push back on Iranian influence. But I also think this is also a story about chemical weapons. And they spent years attacking President Obama for weakness and cowardice and lack of credibility on falling back on his red line for chemical weapons. And I think that this is also a case where we will sometimes see Trump do the right thing for the wrong reasons and in the wrong way. Okay, he may not have told his State Department or his Department of Defense what he was doing when he released his statement threatening Syria, which was a bit of an oversight. But I think they've genuinely gotten specific intelligence showing movement of chemical weapons or units associated with that at Sheirat Airfield. And regardless of the Iran stuff, whatever the proxy war, I think it's not a bad thing if they're making this public and telling Syria, do this again and we will strike you again. It's a bit crude, but I hope it deters another chemical weapons attack.
And Robert, do you think that if Shashank's reading of that is right, therefore one imagines they would have to act were they to then see use of chemical weapons from this facility, perhaps? Would they do that? The appetite, maybe personally, from Trump might be there, but there's a whole secondary raft of considerations. What if they were to engage with Russian-supported air force, for example? You know, do they have the means to act if they want to?
Well, they do, because when they acted before, it was absolutely within UN protocols, the law. It was appropriate. It was proportionate. Actually, it was clinical. It was absolutely by the book, because there had been agreements that they were going to get rid of chemical weapons and that this would happen. That is absolutely so. But the second part of your question, I was looking over both into the Lebanon border and by Quneitra, looking over at Quneitra, where there's been a lot of argy-bargy, and the Israelis have got into rather a strange exchange of fire. And I agree with you, and it's called spillover. All kinds of spillovers. Syrian forces, government forces, by mistake, fired into the Golan Heights, and by mistake, it seems that the Israeli forces replied on the Golan and fired straight into Syrian government forces, who I guess, having looked and just remembering the terrain, would be in New Quneitra. It's a mosaic. It's a muddle. One thing I do fear is shades of 2006, the so-called Second Lebanon War. There, the aphorism was, not that justification, that both sides fought the wrong war. What seems to be building up here, and particularly if Israel gets involved, I had an awful feeling they're going to fight the wrong war all over again. You know, I kept on asking the commanders in the region, what do you assess Hezbollah's war aims to be? You know, where is the operational ground, giving a tactical appreciation? They all wanted to say, we're all prepared, but they would not talk about the thing from an operational point of view. And there are quite scary things in the pipeline. They want a sanitized zone. Goodness, here we go again, up to the Litani River. And that both the at the Herzliya conference, both the IDF commander Eisenkot and the Air Force commander talked about moving hundreds of thousands of civilians out of the area if it comes to blows in the north, in southern Lebanon, and to an extent they mentioned Gaza. What was so interesting is Gaza and what's going on there, and it is boiling away. It's a very serious situation. Isn't a priority at all at the moment. So, really, I see in all this, as your question suggests, the availability of a mistake, of a misstep, or a piece of misspeaking is really quite severe, because it does seem to me that the Syrian armed forces, the Assad regime, which was saved with the Russian Hezbollah operation on Aleppo, they are really not strong enough to hold the ground. And everybody wants to do their own thing. Hezbollah never really wanted to be in the Syrian fight. So they say, now we've got to be able to do things in our own terms, back on our own turf. It is very complex. But because of this obsession with the Iranian standoff with the alliance led by Saudi Arabia, and it is principally Saudi Arabia, there is a tremendous capacity for a spark to really set off something very, very unfortunate, a regional war.
Regional war, Shashank. And you already suggested earlier that we've almost seen people doing, perhaps in some cases, the right thing for the wrong reasons. Robert's talking there about fighting the wrong wars for the wrong reason. I mean, are we now at a point where that seems, if not inevitable, certainly probable, that we're going to see a conflict, and it could be very much the wrong thing and for the wrong reason.
I don't think it's probable. I don't think that I'd put the probability above 50%. I do think the risks are higher than we'd like. And, of course, the issue is that Trump is staking a lot of credibility on this. He's someone who is making decisions on a whim, on a very personalised basis, not really listening to advisers, being roped into some rather harebrained schemes like the blockade on Qatar, even if they are obviously detrimental to American interests. And in that sense, it's always important to remember Russian and Iranian interests in Syria are greater than American interests. So they have more resolve or more stakes, and they will match any escalation. And I worry that there's a sort of misunderstanding of how far they're willing to go.
And just briefly on that point about Trump, it is interesting, of course, you think back to the campaign and even in his early weeks in office, he maintained his fairly sort of isolationist stance. If anything, he was talking about the US not getting involved beyond its shores. Has he just seen that, oh, actually, looking back to that earlier airstrike, some of his pronouncements on this, they've actually been, by Trump standards, relatively well received by the press, by the public. Is there a risk here that he thinks, hey, actually, I can play the foreign policy game. This is
absolutely
a stage that's right for me. Is it his self-interest which is motivating him?
I think that's right. But I think also you talked about isolationism. I think we should always remember it wasn't really about isolationism. It was always about nationalism. It was always about assertions of power. So he doesn't like leadership or leading with allies or burden sharing. That doesn't mean he dislikes acting in the world. He just does. He likes to do it by himself. He likes to do it with him, with American interest foremost, himself in charge. And that's the key distinction. He is not afraid of challenging China over the South China Sea or bombing Iran. What he doesn't want to do is do so because he feels he should, or because of values, or because of some abstract conception of US's leadership over the world.
Let's move to another area with great regional complexity, to India, whose troops have been accused of making incursions into China along the two nations' border. The dispute means that China, in retaliation, is now preventing India's Hindu pilgrims seeking to cross their border to visit holy sites in China. Robert Fox, this is another one that's perhaps doesn't necessarily get the coverage it might warrant, but an undoubted, again, another escalation on an important border.
It's absolutely fascinating, this. It is the regular pilgrimage, as you say, into this area of Sikkim where the Chinese have been quite accommodating, recently allowing a road to be built so that you can take a much shorter cut to the pilgrim sites. But they've got very stroppy of late, and they've closed down, and they're sending pilgrims back, it is thought. And it's not quite clear why, because coincidentally, as you said, there have been accusations of incursions by Indian troops. Goodness knows really what they were doing. They may have got lost or whatever. It is a very, very sensitive and friable border. But in the deep background, again, as you rightly say, not unrelated to what we were saying before about Trump and the standoff, the Qatar business, China has got very, very grumpy about the Modi visit to Trump and the announcement, and it just quantitatively it doesn't seem enormous, that that they're selling 22 Predator Reaper Guardian drones, US, from General Atomic manufacturer, to essentially to the Indian Navy. But probably Shashank knows far more about this than I do. It is linked to a big surveillance architecture, which is done through and with another very important element, the P-8 surveillance plane, which the Brits are also buying. And this has really annoyed the Chinese for two reasons. One, in terms of unmanned aerial vehicles, in other words, drones, it means that India has now joined the Predator Club, which is very, very important indeed, which doesn't contain a threat as such, because I think that they've jibbed about selling the Predators, which are capable of firing weapons. But there, you know, that can be managed. But the fact that they are now joining a surveillance net which can plug in not only to the US, to the Japanese, but also the Australians, seems really to have upset the Chinese. The Chinese, by the way, have been sending their drone technology. Hey, here's a surprise to Pakistan, who have been using strike drones. Can I draw a breath? But there's also been action against Iranian drones. Sorry, I haven't gone off on one, because there's a synergy between Iran and India. And so it is getting very, very complex. And what the Chinese are saying, they like stability. They don't want messing around. This takes capability to a new level. And I think they're pretty annoyed with India's current military posture, because they are upgrading, because they bought F-16 planes. There's still a strike plane deal with Rafale due with France. And they're not that far behind China, and China is beginning to generate, at last, innovate its own defence industry. But it is a real rival, and I think this is a rivalry which will go on for most of the century, and as potential pitfalls, because this is just another little tripwire. This making a diplomatic gesture over the pilgrims. It's not about, I think, the incursion by the troops per se, but it's an excuse to have a bit of a go.
And Shoshan, do you go along with that? We talked before about these little flashpoints, these skirmishes, tripwires, as Robert calls them. Is it again the same thing? There's a bigger, again, maybe a sort of a proxy, I don't know what you'd call a difference of opinion between the two, which again is informed by other actors as well. So it's the bigger picture we have to try and look at here.
Oh, of course. And Robert's highlighted some very important parts of that background. It's the world's biggest border dispute, by the way. Not just any border dispute. The Chinese claim the Indian state of Arunachal Pradesh, calling it South Tibet. That's the size of Switzerland. You know, it's not a sort of little sliver of land caught between something, like Alsace-Lorraine or something. And on the west, you know, the Indians claim the Aksai Chin Plateau. What's really interesting about this latest episode is really two things. One of them is it comes after a lot of tension over Tibet specifically. And Sikkim's right next to Tibet. The pilgrimage site that the Chinese have blocked access to is in Tibet. And the Dalai Lama recently visited this town of Tawang in Arunachal Pradesh in the east of India, which is where he fled Tibet from in 1959 when chased out by the Chinese. And the Chinese, of course, are very nervous about what happens when he dies. You know, will they be able to claim his successor? Oh, look, he's been born in China and he's conveniently under the CCP's, the Communist Party's control. Or will the Dalai Lama, he's threatening, of course, to say, well, I might not reincarnate in China. The India might be in India. And then the other important point, I think, is worth highlighting, a little bit niche, but most of the India-China border is not delineated or agreed between the two sides. It's called a line of actual control. Not a line of control, it's in India-Pakistan, where they agree at least where it goes. A line of actual control. They don't know where it is. It's just they both agree where troops are. In Sikkim, there is an international border. So they agree where the border is. It's not like the other bits. And yet there's still been a clash. And this is really interesting, because actually what appears to have occurred is a clash is in an area claimed by Bhutan against China. And India seems to be acting on behalf of the Bhutanese government. So actually, this is at the tri-junction of those countries. So it's not your ordinary India-China skirmish. This has additional sort of layers of complexity to it.
And presumably, given those complexities, does that therefore increase the risk of people putting a foot wrong metaphorically, whether it's the people on the ground who could say, well, we don't really know what our boundaries are, we're supposed to be observing.
Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, look, if you talk to Indian officials, they say, yeah, we both make incursions into the other person's claimed territory because we don't know where the border is. There's no markers. We go in, we leave packets as crisps to show we've been there. We hold banners up to say this is Indian territory if we see someone else. But the Indian army chiefs agree. No one really knows where the border is exactly. In Sikkim, it's, you know, pretty well demarked, so we do know. In other parts, though, it's really how far do you want to patrol and take a risk?
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, Robert Fox and Shashank Joshi. Coming up next, we'll look at the relationship between China and the UK and why Hong Kongers play a vital role. Stay tuned.
If you're looking for perfect harmony, Prague is the place. The Czech National Symphony Orchestra is enjoying a renaissance and international recognition, attracting clients as diverse as Ennio Morricone and Sting.
The most important difference is that we are able to change the musicians day by day. We have about 250 musicians. It's like a hockey team, a football team. We have the possibility to create really the best selection.
Monocle Films went to the Czech capital to find out more about their success. Watch the film now on monocle.com.
You're with Midori House, still with me, Shashank Joshi and Robert Fox. The former governor of Hong Kong, Chris Patten, has accused the UK of kowtowing to China on issues such as human rights. It's been 20 years this year since the UK, Patten at that time, handed the territory of Hong Kong back to China. Robert Fox, in a post-Brexit world, or an imminently post-Brexit world, I use imminently loosely there, the UK needs all the friends it can get. How do you think the nation needs to be picking its acquaintances? And have we seen an example of how to or how not to do it when we look to Hong Kong?
Well, Hong Kong just seems to be a standard. What Patten is complaining about, and he's now the strong man, there's nothing but like being strong once you're out of office, that he thinks the Brits haven't made enough fuss about the agreements, particularly the agreements on human rights being acknowledged. He's particularly worried about the disappearance, let's call it that, of the booksellers. And elections are coming up, and he thinks that we should jolly well be doing a Margaret Thatcher and banging the table. It must be one of the lower items of priority on Mrs. Theresa May, the current British Prime Minister's list of priorities.
I wonder if it's in the intro.
Exactly. And Patten is also saying that it shows, you know, that we have, that Britain is aiming to float off into the Atlantic and to be this great sort of geopolitical mini aircraft carrier. I'm talking about in politics, and it's got to make friends around the world. I find there's something fractured about his thinking, but he is really talking old internationalist Tory speak. He's talking the language of, you know, senior grandees like Ken Clark, still in Parliament, now in the House of Lords, Lord Heseltine. And it's not really constructive, because he is still part of that party. And we who are not part of that party have no idea, really, how they envisage the parameter, the pathway of Brexit negotiations, and in the end, what the relationship between the UK and how much of the UK and Europe is going to be. And I'm pretty dismayed, because I don't think even Patten is really helping with that. It does highlight really how fractured the nominally governing party in the UK is. You get what I would call the flat earth extremes, people like John Redwood, who think that they, you know, all evil comes from Europe and we'll get rid of everything. And just to spell it out, it's get rid of the customs union, get outside the single market. And this kind of protest and what on earth the Chinese would think of us, well, what on earth they really do think of us. But knowing a bit about Chinese diplomacy, they're going to wait and see. And again, it's not priority one for them. Priority one for them is they just jolly well don't want a fuss over the Hong Kong elections. This is a bit of history, and it does show you where this great movement, which has always managed to renew itself, I'm talking about the British Conservative Party, is having a hell of a time doing it now.
Shashank, it's rather interesting that one of the few parts of the world where we're seeing interest in acquiring British passports and potentially moving to Britain is from Hong Kong, where Hong Kongers, some of them, are a bit worried about what the future holds. Before we maybe come back to that idea about how Brexit shapes up, you know, does Patten have a point about the British handling of Hong Kong and the legacy of 97? Or is, as Robert points out, he maybe being rather wise after the fact?
No, absolutely. I think, of course, we shouldn't overestimate the influence we have over China on an issue that it sees as fundamental. It's really important to recall here, when the agreement was signed in 97, or in the years before that agreed, the importance of Hong Kong's economy to the Chinese economy was enormous. And any political effort to interfere in that and undermine the political economic rights or political rights that would jeopardize foreign exchange and all of it would have been really bad for the Communist Party. Mm. Now, of course, in the incredible change that's taken place in 20 years to China's economy, Hong Kong matters far less, and therefore they are able to do much more with far more impunity, whatever the agreement says. On the other hand, I think we have this chronic sense of, if we wish to keep a healthy economic relationship, we must toe the line. Mm. And I think that's completely false. We've talked about India just now. Mm. India and China have enormous trade. And of course, China's investing billions into India. And yet they have a massive border dispute and militarized hostility. The China and the United States, you know, openly threatening China over the South China Sea, up and down in a relationship. And yet, of course, trade continues apace. I think we need to have more self-confidence in ourselves as an economic power and actually say we are allowed to talk about freedom of navigation and norms about using force and about human rights, and not be afraid that the Chinese will turn around and isolate us. But of course, I do find it very depressing that our ability to be isolated will now increase as we drift away from the European Union. I think that's inevitable.
Indeed. Well, one other thing that does unite the UK and China is they both have some brand new naval hardware to play with. And I want to ask you about this briefly. The UK is hoping to put the new HMS Queen Elizabeth aircraft carrier, £3.5 billion worth of it, I think, to sea. China's launching its own home-built 10,000-ton destroyer. Which ship do you like the look of the best, Robert?
The Chinese, because it's far more useful.
Oh, there you go. That was, again, another short answer.
because the aircraft carrier is lovely. It's a miracle of engineering. They could just about squeak it under the bridges. It's not going to be effective, even at half its capacity, for another 6 to 8 years. And one wonders what a very medium power, which is becoming increasingly isolated, like Britain, is doing with a thing like that. Because if you put it into any serious contested waters, you've got to protect it with surface ships, with aircraft, with surveillance aircraft, much of which it will carry in with its helicopters. But above all, or below all, rather, it's got to have two submarines to keep people away from it, from its hull. The Royal Navy hasn't got that. The Royal Navy and the British Armed Forces are seriously hollowed out, are seriously depleted. And given the present political and fiscal crisis, I don't see that changing very soon.
It's worth noting, of course, the Chinese are also building their own carriers. So it's not as if they're choosing between this ship and this carriers. I mean, they've also gone all in on carriers. And despite the problems Robert correctly points out about the vulnerability of big platforms, how expensive they are to run, it is nonetheless extremely interesting to see the Chinese building their first indigenous carrier, sea trials last year or earlier this year. The Indians putting their first carrier down to sea, building two more in due course. You know, the world of carriers and carrier aviation will be with us for another century, which not everyone would have predicted.
Robert, if this threatens to be, a bit of a sort of white elephant at sea for Britain, was that avoidable? We had conversations about this precise end game coming around. Was it avoidable? Were mistakes
entirely
made, procurement costs?
It was entirely avoidable. Because it is the design process, sorry to use the awful metaphor, it is like the supertanker and turning it round. They probably got the wrong design. They were offered a very good template, which is the slightly smaller two-thirds size carrier, which the US Marine Corps used, which is an evolution of the Wasp and Guam class, which the UK, with its economy, with the kind of armed forces it could support, could man and support much more effectively than these magnificent monsters. But they are monsters, and it will take virtually between a third and 60% of the resources of the surface fleet of the Navy to really man them, if they man them both, to make them fully operational. And there's a huge problem with training crew, particularly technical crew, because we may just about have enough aircraft for one of the aircraft carriers. We certainly don't have the pilots.
We're edging towards the end of the programme, I did want to briefly head to Italy. One of the parties that had a pretty good showing at some of the mayoral elections in Italy last week was Forza, the party led by none other than former President Silvio Berlusconi. He's been barred for public office for some time, but he's appealing that decision at the Court of Human Rights later. Some say he may be poised for a comeback. Another question, Shashank, to which I may invite a relatively compact answer. Should we gird ourselves for the return of Berlusconi? And if we do, does anyone actually want him back?
Yes, he was a populist before populist. He was a forerunner to Trump. He showed Trump how it's done, controlling media organisations, using television, rousing crowd. And of course, now is the time for extremes in European politics. And he has stepped back into the fray just as the time is ripe for populists of left and right.
And Robert, briefly, if Berlusconi is indeed on the returning trail, should we welcome one of the great characters, or should we fear what he might get up to if he's successful?
No, he joins the great clown gallery in Italy because he'll be there along with Beppe Grillo of the Five Star Movement, and that's the reason why he's there, because Five Star, it's got a solid 25% showing, although it didn't do so well, as Shashank was pointing out, in the recent local election. No, it is a huge muddle. Berlusconi will be back. He'll be very prominent, but he'll be a bit like that statue of Jeremy Bentham outside University College or the cigar store India, which he resembles more and more. But I don't think he will be prime minister, not least because he's barred. But above all, he's part of a pairing now. It's absolutely dichotomous. He really has critical mass if he pals up with the Northern League. They're about 14-15% each, and then they go to the 30%. So far, the Lega Nord is saying we're not having the old cigar boy back.
Well, we'll keep a weather eye. What a great pleasure to speak to Robert Fox and Shashank Joshi on today's edition of Midori House. And that's all we have time for on the programme, which was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Audrey Fyodorenko, and studio managed by Toby Hammond. Do join us at the same time tomorrow, 1800 here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks for listening.